Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Inside Trek, the Megan Talks podcast, where we give you the inside Trek on all things Star Trek. I'm your host, Lee. I'm joined by my co-host, BJ. BJ, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. I'm excited to talk about this episode with you. I've been foreshadowing it for, I feel like 4 or 5 episodes now. So yeah. I'm excited
You have, I mean, you multiple times you have kind of said, okay, well, we need to schedule it this way because this episode's really good. You've referenced it, the episode being good, multiple times. I think you've told me before that the second to last episode in the season was pretty good, and then series starts to pick up. And I guess you could have a worry with that it might be hyped up too much. I might expect too much or whatever. Not at all. This is a really good episode of television. It was just flatly good. We've joked a lot about this series, kind of the up and downs. I think I have what did I cook up the last episode? The wacky meter or the kooky meter or something. This is not even on that scale. I mean, it's just a very interesting, well done story, and it's so interesting to. I mean, first off, the episode's really good. But what's interesting to me in talking about the series is that this episode can exist with Hopscotch in the same season, and you're like, what is this show? Is this SNL? Is this like a variety hour? Like,
it's wild.
How is it so brilliant at times? And then sometimes you're watching it and you're like, yep, I mean, to your point, skippable, right? So, it's interesting to me how the quality, how it can shift. But when they're capable of doing an episode like this, I feel like you got to keep watching.
Yeah. This is one of the episodes that, when I think about the show, this is an episode that like stands out. I remember it. Bree famously doesn't remember anything ever, basically. But you know, I'll be like, "Oh, you remember this episode?" She's like, "Oh yeah, that was a really good one."
She does often forget who I am, so that's true. Yeah. It's very true.
She remembers Hopscotch, but for a slightly different reason, obviously.
Yeah. The memes. She's been seeing the memes on her timeline.
Yeah. But yeah, this one just, it hits hard. And it's, in some very interesting ways, doesn't do anything to further any story.
Hmm.
But it does so much to flesh out the world.
Yeah, I don't know what you mean. Like, I guess we would have to parse that phrase, flesh, you know, to advance the story, right? Because I do think we have been, in a lot of ways, this first season has been more about Kira than anybody else. And about her transformation, where we get her the first scene of episode one, and she's just punchy. She's yelling at everybody. She's Bajoran first, everybody else last.
Yeah.
You don't know how long she's going to make it. And here she's holding a dying Cardassian with tears in her eyes, like irate at another Bajoran for killing him. And this was a guy who worked in a labor camp. Like he did work there. And that growth of Kira, I mean, I know these are mostly episodic, but I feel like that's the big story of season one is Kira changing in the depth of her character.
Yeah. And so I think that is one of the really great things about where
episode's
they take,
called Duet, by the way. We didn't even say the episode name. Episode Duet, episode 19.
Yeah,
the second to last penultimate episode of season one.
Yeah. And the Deep Space Nine is where they start realizing that you can serialize the show as opposed to having a purely episodic show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're getting hints of that, but I guess where I say they're not forwarding anything, like we have a lot of stuff going on with Bajor trying to figure out their way into the Federation. Maybe,
O'Brien and Dax. O'Brien and Dax.
O'Brien and Dax, very important,
important romantic
love story.
Angle.
Bashir and Garak, the power couples of our station. Maybe a little Quark and Odo to go along with it.
Quark and Odo for sure. Yeah.
I think that there are some main themes of the show that we already have a bit that have started being teased, like, what is Odo? Where is he from? Like, what's going on there? We have what's going to happen with the Cardassians and the relationship with the Federation, the relationship with Bajor, Bajor's relationship with the Federation. And that was very much back burner, at least for me, this episode. And a lot of this was, it was a Kira-centered episode. And it was also like everybody dealing with the traumas of war and occupation, and, you know, the atrocities of this, what happened between the Cardassians and Bajor. And it's just, it's interesting to me, and I think I see where it gets some dings, like not being higher than a 9, in comparison to like more recent shows. It's one of the top.
So I contrasted it at the start of the episode. I said how it's interesting to me that the show can have such highs and what I think are such lows.
Yeah.
Two writers of this episode, Lisa Rich and Janine Carrigan Fauci. Janine Carrigan Fauci also wrote Move Along Home. And that and Duet are her only two credits for DS9.
Yeah.
It's hilarious to me. It's like, I get like the worst episode, the best episode. There you go. Boom.
Yeah.
Forget the quality discussion too. Also just like the difference in those stories, the tone, the type of story that's being told, what kind of show they think it is. Like, I feel like it's just so different. I wonder what in the hell happened between her writing those two different screenplays.
Yeah. I have no idea. It's just fascinating. I have no idea like what went on there. And it's also interesting, like they both have like these two credits. So like, I just don't know. Maybe they wrote this and then wrote the other. And, you know, that was sort of like they got to write a second one, but man, I don't know. Like,
it's strange. It's not, you know, of course you're questioning the quality, but it's also what kind of writers are these that they do a, you know, I don't know. It just feels like two entirely different styles, different mechanisms of storytelling. So it's interesting to me that they were written by the same people. We don't normally do a recap here, but I think we can kind of loosely talk about what happened, because I think that'll help guide the conversation a little bit. So a Cardassian man arrives in the station. He says he's suffering from an illness that immediately Kira picks up on the name of the illness. And that's an illness that was born out of a labor camp in Bajor that was particularly bad that Kira helped to liberate. Yeah. And as the guy is the prisoner, questions start to arise about his story, where he says he's from, his illness. They do a series of tests on the illness. He kind of changes his story multiple times, but he starts out by telling everybody that he is this guy.
Maritza, the clerk of Maritza, Kalnora.
Who has Podrick syndrome, right? That's what he says.
Yeah.
Which is a condition similar to Kayla Nora, which is the disease that came out of the labor camp, right?
Yeah.
And when he says he's Maritza, they do some checking into that, and they figure out that he actually, his physical features, his looks actually tracks with Dol Gadot, right? Which is Goldarheel, who was basically the head of the camp. He was the head of the atrocities. He's the guy you certainly can point the finger at and blame for what occurred in this labor camp. And as the story progresses, Kira wants to punish this guy, get him in front of a war tribunal immediately. And Sisko keeps digging, as the Federation tends to do. And we find out that this actually isn't Goldarheel. Goldar Heel, he is actually the file clerk, the first name that he gave. And he has changed his physical appearance to look like
the Gull.
Goldar here. And has done so. Sorry, I was looking at the recap, and Gul Dukat is another guy who comes into the story. Yeah, I'm just getting Goldar Heel. And you want to jump in?
Yeah, so I was just going to say, like, for your list of things, the Gull is basically just commander.
Okay, that makes sense. That would explain it. So, as the Cardassians, Gul Dukat becomes important because he's putting pressure on them to release the guy, right? And then the Bajorans are also putting pressure to release the guy to them so that they can have this war tribunal. Of course, Kira's pushing for that. And they learn that he actually is the file clerk. He's changed his looks to look like Goldar Heel. And Kira has this like series of very epic conversations with him, culminating in one where she's like, why are you doing this? And he continues to try to pretend to be Goldar Heel, and he breaks. And when he breaks down, he explains that they all the Cardassians need to answer for what happened on Bajor. And this is his attempt to do so, that if he can get in front of the war tribunal as Goldar Heel, it can be litigated and there can be some sort of recognition from the Cardassian people that they did something wrong here.
Yeah.
And as the story tends to do, it's flipped on its head from where you think 20 minutes in, whatever's going on 20 minutes in is wrong. You could bet in this story. And she releases him. She's going to let him go, give him the medicine he needs, send him back on his ship. And another Bajoran stabs him and he dies. And that's the scene I was talking about at the end where she's holding his dead body. Fantastic story. Just a really tight, fantastic story. It wasn't one where I felt like they were rushing us, but they told an important, interesting story that has a lot of real world parallels.
Yep. A lot. And it's also really interesting, like the couple of things that they sprinkle in, which have like are good in world things to be doing and will come up, you know, generally will come up later. So Gul Dukat was the former commander of Deep Space Nine under the Cardassians. So that he's like the point person kind of makes sense, but also is kind of like a real dick move on the Cardassians side of things. It's just like, I 100% would be surprised if they did this, but like, you know, if the UK, withdrew the governor of India and then it's just like, oh, by the way, he's the ambassador now. So,
It's pretty strange. It creates a strange dynamic for sure.
Yeah.
To talk about what they were trying to say in this episode? I mean, was this a direct World War II story? I mean, is this do you think that it was that linear, or do you think there were other real world parallels they were going for? Or post World War II story, I mean?
I think post World War II, I think that it's
because it also felt a little like a discussion about apartheid, which was very much in the consciousness.
Yeah,
the post reconciliation in South Africa, which at the time was only a year or two old, right when they were making this.
Yeah,
so that could have been that, and it also the way that they treat, like, it's interesting to me that they go with, this guy was just a file clerk. We all know that he should be released and he shouldn't be held accountable for this, right? Because there were certainly times in our national consciousness, or heck, most of the Western world's consciousness, where we did not agree with that logic.
Yeah.
We were like, you were still working for the bad guy. You were still participating in this. You heard the screams. I mean, he admits to hearing the screams. He covered his ears. He calls himself a coward because he didn't even want to hear it. So he knew that what was going on there, but they all sort of just accept that he should be released and that's okay. That was like one of the major questions I had coming out of it as a viewer. I was like, did everybody have the same experience I did? Which is where you question the sort of assumption of everybody on Deep Space Nine that this guy should just go. I mean, I'm not arguing that he's doing a bold and heroic thing here, maybe not heroic, but a pretty noteworthy and impressive thing here.
Right.
But he, like, you did kind of participate in this thing, dude. I don't know that we just let him go.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, like, the Nuremberg trials from World War II were not, like, I mean, ongoing until not terribly long ago. I think that there's some apartheid in it. There's probably some, is it Kosovo that was, or is that, that was a little bit afterwards, because that was Clinton. Rwanda, but I mean, it was also a thing, but no, like, there was all the infighting in the former Soviet Union shortly after it fell. I'm not 100% sure about the names of all the countries in the area, because they've changed a lot since I learned some of them in grade school. So,
Too. Your brain's changed a lot. You might have forgotten a couple.
Exactly. Getting old these days. So I think it's looking at a lot of those things, and as a taking a big look at who do you punish, why do you punish them, who is worthy of punishment, and what do you do with people that were associated with evil? And, like, what do you do with things that were associated with evil? Just generally, you know, it's a bigger question. Because, like, there's no question in, you know, essentially anybody's minds, but maybe Gul Dukat, that Guldar Hill was a bad person, needed to go before, you know, tribunals and pay for his crimes.
Well, it sounds like Gul Dukat is not alone in that, right? Because he described the funeral for Guldar Hill, and then his body was on display for like 6 days, and everybody had a chance to come say goodbye to this hero. And so I agree that the portrayal and the details we get about him are that he was a bad guy, but
yeah,
it just makes me continue to question what is going on with the Cardassians. They seem completely awful.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we get some people that are reasonable, but like it's a very uncomfortable look into a militaristic regime that I think the Nazi parallels are you know, not only ripe for the picking, but, you know, they're there for a reason. And I think this is when you combine military inefficiency into, you know, sort of an entire, alien group, like, what does that do to its neighbors? Not very far off of, there's a show, Men in High Castle, that was a bit about like an alternate universe where the Nazis didn't lose. Right. And I feel like there are some parallels there where it's just like, if you have that group that has that mentality, like, they're not going to agree that the things that, you know, the reasonable Federation considers war crimes were war crimes. Yes. I think it's just, it's an interesting bit to have put in there.
Agreed. But they don't allow the viewer to just accept that in the Cardassian society they have a different view of it, nationalism, pride in their race, etc., because they give us a Cardassian who doesn't have that view, who was there, who saw it, and knows it was wrong. So we can't just sort of hand wave the society anymore. When they give us a detail like this, I think they actually want us to be pretty critical of the Cardassian society as a whole. Because they painted with a pretty broad brush there, that detail, which was, this guy was treated like Abraham Lincoln. He was put out in public.
Yeah.
People were coming by for days and days to say goodbye to him. And one of his fucking filing clerk thinks he was so evil that he's willing to do this whole kamikaze routine just to try to sully the guy's name, but also to get some sort of justice or peace for the situation, yeah. apology on behalf of the Cardassian people. So you can't just like watch it and go, well, that, you know, they just have a different value set. It's not like the what Quark is, right? What Quark species?
Yeah, the Ferengi.
Yeah, the Ferengi. Every single one of them we've seen has been like, we make a deal, we make money. Like, that's, we're pretty self-interested. Yeah. If they gave us a Ferengi who was like, you know what, guys, we really, capitalism probably isn't the way. Like, you know, some people get left behind. Then it would kind of fuck up the whole thing, right? But they don't give us that. I can continue to view Quark with a certain lens. But I thought it was interesting, that parallel of giving us the character, giving us the Cardassian who sees it, and then telling us, yeah, but the vast majority of people don't.
Yeah. It's also interesting that it's... I was looking up what this episode reminds me of a lot is Schindler's List. Mm. And that came out in 1994. This came out in 1993. So clearly not pulling from that, but, you know, maybe there was some cross contamination or something. I mean, like, it's not a, you know, it's a story that would have been known. But
I got one problem with Schindler's List. You want to guess what it was? If you had to say one problem BJ has with the movie Schindler's List, if you have one, what would it be?
Man, I don't know. I haven't seen it recently enough to pick at something minor. I'm trying to think of like a big...
The black and white to color. When they change the black and white to color when you see the survivors who are walking hand in hand at the end in modern day.
Yeah.
I hated that.
Okay.
I didn't like it at all. The black and white to color gives the impression that this was fixed. That like, we got to the other side of this and now it's all like gravy train. Like, it's all good. It's like these people lived with horrendous trauma their entire life and worked probably every day, every hour to try to move on from those memories. Like, it's not just, you know what, it's over and it's all good. That's a very United States centric thinking, that we came in, we liberated them, and yay, it all got fixed, all good.
Yeah,
other than that movie's fantastic.
That's fair. I mean, I will say that, like, there is an aspect to moving on that is also sort of intrinsic to a lot of survivors, that are just like, it is a defining thing, but if you let it define you, then like there is a power that you allow it to have. It's a complicated, I don't know. It's a complicated thing, and I that does make sense that just hits wrong. And there's an aspect to this story that is more heartfelt, because it's not just happy in the end, and it's not just like, let's highlight a story of not something happy. Not something sad per se, but like just a, this is a story. This is a story of a thing that happened. It's not, the outcome wasn't great. It's not somebody terribly evil. This is just a dude and an experience that was had in a terrible place at a terrible time. And he was on the other side.
But, so yes, I see what you're saying, and I do like that piece of it too, that they weren't telling, it wasn't, there was no real hero here, but he does do something fairly monumental when he decides, I'm going to spend the last X years of my life prepping for this moment where I can pretend to be this guy and cosplay this guy in front of a war tribunal to get some sort of justice on behalf of the Bajoran people, to stand there and for them to publicly condemn what happened, for it to be aired. Like, there's a lot of people who participated in atrocities who say they're sorry.
Yeah.
This is another level of I'm sorry. That is pretty, pretty incredible to think about. And
yeah,
it's, I think that the magnitude of what he's doing is what really fundamentally changes Kira. Like, that's where she looks at it and goes, okay, it took something at that level to get through to her that she could be friends with a Cardassian, that they are not all bad. And that's why the last line is the last line, when she's like, no, they're not all the same. Like, I understand that now through this. And that's why I don't know where the story's going, but I suspect that it does have long-term ramifications on the plot, because now Kira, even though she has made some progress in her journey through PTSD, really, and her dealing with being a soldier most of her life, now she's made what seems like real progress in this blind racism, this blind hatred of a particular species, right? Like, she just hated all Cardassians until this moment. And it took this sort of like really huge, I don't think, if that guy showed up and he goes, I was a filing clerk, I'm sorry, should have done that, that just sucks, Kira would be like, fuck you, get back in your cell. Like, it took something that she couldn't even conceive of for her to go, all right, I got it now.
Yeah, 100%. I also think that Odo helped her understand a lesson of there is value to procedure, and there's value to justice. And like, it can't just be theater, because, you know, sort of at the end, like, her coming to understand that, like, letting him pretend to be Guldarheel, and to a certain extent, even punishing him as the role that you could ascribe to him as a clerk, isn't going to be healthy for anybody involved in that.
Well, like, can I argue the other side here?
Sure.
He probably doesn't want the logic to be, well, if you helped and worked with the Cardassians at all, then you were participating in evil. Because guess who worked with the Cardassians? Odo. Just saying.
Yeah. And
he didn't work at the labor camp. There is a difference, right? But like, I don't know. You know, so the cynical could look at that and go, hey, maybe there's a reason he doesn't like that logic.
Has the show talked a bit about what Deep Space Nine was before it was Deep Space Nine?
All I know is that it was there. Obviously there was no wormhole, and they were the Cardassians ran the thing.
Okay. I think that they have dropped a couple of small pieces, but it'll be a thing in the future. And I just didn't want to spoil it or anything like that.
By the way, anyway, I don't really believe that was a motivating factor for Odo, but I do think it's worth calling out that if they have clearly made the decision that if you were operating in relatively good faith under the Cardassians and other people involved in that regime were doing evil things, then those people were responsible for the evil things they were doing, not the people who were operating in relatively good faith like Odo, right? And I think they're applying the same logic to the bookkeeper.
Yeah. And I think that the bookkeeper goes a little bit further, and it's sort of a hard pill to swallow, which is, you know, let's say you're looking at, you know, the tobacco companies, you know, did the people that knew that it was harmful, and helped with advertising and helped target children and you know, did all those things, like, where does that being problematic end? Like, you know, does anybody that worked for Philip Morris, you know, are they reprehensible? Like, that's also like a hard pill to swallow.
There's certainly degrees, and also degrees of the overall regime's evilness, right?
Yeah. Like,
Philip Morris, evil. On the evil spectrum, I'm not quite sure Philip Morris lands with Nazis, right? So I think that, like, if you were working with the Nazis, then maybe there's a little bit of a difference in our expectations for your behavior as somebody who was seeing those atrocities. What I found particularly damning about our guy, which, by the way, I would have let him go too. I would have. But what I found damning is when he said, I had to cover my ears because of the screams of the, everything was so awful that I was trying, I was personally trying to get away from it. That's just an admission that you were fully aware of everything going on there and you continued to participate in it too. Now he then follows up and calls himself a coward. And part of the reason I'm letting this guy go is because I'm not in the Federation and I don't need to like follow the letter of the law perfectly. And I think this whole fucking thing he's done shows where his heart is. Like this whole thing is like, okay, dude, like you are sorry. Like we got it. Like we don't need to throw you in jail for 10 years. We understand that you're sorry for this, but I just think it's the show breezed over that part of it. And I was wondering if other, I just wonder if other people who watch it have the same reaction. Like, whoa, this guy's not, even when you get the reveal, he's really the bookkeeper. This guy's not got clean hands.
I mean, yeah, I mean, he's not at all got clean hands. And I mean, he was compiling reports on intelligence. Like he played a major role in the Cardassian machine on Bajor. But I think that there's also the aspect of, you know, what are his future goals that it's hard to look at and weigh without prejudice one way or the other. And I mean, there are a whole host of, you know, how much good and how much use does somebody have to have compared to, you know, the things that they've done that we find acceptable. I mean, I think the easiest one to pull from is Operation Paperclip. And, you know, a whole host of things after that from, you know, that the U.S. is somewhat famous for. And there's a...
Why don't we explain what Operation Paperclip is
for people? So Operation Paperclip and, you know, there are other things associated with that were the U.S. basically evacuated a bunch of scientists from Germany and dragged them into... do rocketry research and a whole bunch of other things like that. So there was a joke that was, I mean, made it into a movie, Dr. Strangelove, which was basically, you know, if you went into the NASA engineer's room and said, you know, Sieg Heil, you'd have a whole bunch of people saluting. Hmm. And
it's not good.
Yeah, so there's the, you know, what sort of things does somebody try and do to, you know, atone for their sins and or, you know, what is it, are there uses for them in society that are worth more than the culturally accepted consequence? And I feel like that's, you know, what they're trying to end up with. And I think a lot of people would agree. And I think a lot of people would disagree that, you know, just because this person can make some sort of positive impact with the rest of their life, you know, should they get the opportunity to? And it's, I mean, you know, probably the most famous person that did this maybe the most successfully is Alfred Nobel. Because most people only associated him with the prize and not anything else that he did before that. So,
well, let's not be cryptic. Tell people what he did before that.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So, Nobel, did a lot of work with explosives, TNT, dynamite, and mm-hmm. its use, I believe, in war. And, you know, he probably helped start usher in an age of larger bombs and more mass casualties from bombs than where we were before that in warfare. And so with his fortune, he basically established the Nobel Prize and, you know, wanted to dedicate people's efforts to peace and sort of the betterment of society.
After he'd armed everybody and gave them ways to kill lots of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I got you there. Yeah. I mean, I think I've had, you know, I remember there's been a couple examples in the last 10 years of extremely old people who worked with, I say extremely old, that sounds really pejorative, like in their 90s, late 90s, who, who had worked with the Nazis and were on trial. And I remember asking you very specifically one time about this, I think on a podcast, I was like, what would you do in this situation? And I think your answer, which I thought felt like was a good one, was you can convict somebody and not necessarily, what you have to think about the sentencing, like what would the actual punishment be for this? Like, yes, you can say you were guilty of this, but do you throw a 99-year-old man in jail? I don't know. Maybe the answer is no to that. But yeah, I don't know. I think that this episode asks a lot of questions, but it's not a question. It's not a show that, or it's not an episode that does that to the detriment of the dynamics of the show that are ongoing, right? Because it's continuing to flesh out the Bajoran-Cardassian conflict and why there's so much difficulty on the Bajoran side, how there are people who are just wrecked from this, like Kira. There are people who are still really hostile, like the guy who stabbed him. There are people who are still have a bit of an issue about power because the Bajorans were sort of run over by the Cardassians. And so like, I think the people who are now the current people who are running the provisional Cardassian government or the provisional Bajoran government, I think you could say have maybe issues with power and are struggling, learning what power is because they didn't have it. Right. All those dynamics exist. And this helps to explain it. It gives backstory to it. Kira, all of her backstory existed, and we're moving her character forward because now she's able to view Cardassians as individuals and not a collective entirely, right? Like all of the, so they dump an interesting story in the middle of this like fantasy show that has real world ties, that asks very specific, pointed, relevant questions, that also continues to further the story we've been told the entire season. That's why I think it was so good. You could have either one of those things, and it's fine. You could have a show that progresses the plot and it's interesting, but it doesn't add, there's no heft to it. There's no intellectual heft to it. And you could also have something that has tons of intellectual heft to it, but you just stop all the characters in place and you give us nothing for the broader story. Both of those can still be good, but together it makes for a great episode.
Yeah. And I think there are a lot of really good pieces of culture that this is pulling from, that it does such a good job. To a certain extent, this is a flashback. But it in some ways reminds me of 12 Angry Men, because instead of actually putting him on trial, instead of, you know, we could have had an actual flashback and, you know, gone through, you know, and seen a little bit more of what was going on. It's in the questioning, discussion, there are sort of little pieces of you know, background research that we get that slowly fill out the story of what really happened, of what, you know, Guldar Heel did, of what Maritza did, of and how he's been living in, you know, the past 10-20 years. And this is also put in a really interesting context with Kira, because we start this episode and she's talking about her childhood with Dax. That's where we start it.
Yep.
And it's like in that backdrop of, you have sort of a maybe a little bit of a normal childhood, and then very quickly, we know that Kira progressed into a resistance cell. And, you know, this is one of the horrors that she faced. I mean, yes, liberating, but the accounts of, you know, basically every soldier from every war, I mean, this one's particularly reminiscent of World War II, but, you know, we get the similar things in Vietnam and Korea and other places where the horrors that soldiers have seen have affected them and traumatized them. And this is trauma that, you know, she's working through.
I I think another piece of this that is interesting to me is that they, when they didn't do a flashback and instead they let the truth kind of drip out through the storytelling.
Yeah.
Is they create moments of like horror when he assumes the role of Goldicott. And he stands there when he starts gesticulating and saying, I loved all the killing and I love the torture and I love the raping and all of this. It's a horror scene. It's horrific yep. hearing him recount this stuff and take glee in it. It's very like Joker, like Batman Joker, right? Like the yep. new dark interpretation of Joker where it's like this like gleeful psychopath. And that's what's interesting about that in retrospect is that this guy's the guy who was the file clerk for him. That's how he views the guy.
Yeah. When
he looks at Goldicott, that's how he views him. He was beat. That's, oh, I got to be my boss. This is what I'll be. And it's this like horror show. But yeah. that scene drove home to me. Okay. Well, Kira is not, cause that's another interesting tension is that us like Sisko, we're not sure how much we can believe of Kira when she starts talking about this stuff. Cause she's so invested in it, but she's not lying about this. She's absolutely recounting the truth about what happened here.
Yeah.
And when Goldicott, the cosplayer Goldicott, starts doing the whole spiel, it's a horrific moment, but it also reinforces, okay, Kira's telling the truth here. I like that a lot. That's so much more effective than if it had just gone back and showed it to us. It's a tell, don't show.
Yeah. Which is an interesting aspect of how they tell, and it's so much better than showing. And it's also interesting that there's an aspect to him impersonating the head of Galatep, and like he can't contemplate and he does not have an understanding of, you know, the Gullen head at the head of Galatep. He just doesn't, like, it doesn't compute because, like, he's like, well, they had to have gloried in this. Like, this is the only way. And maybe that's the case and maybe not, but it's the, how do you come to terms with horrible things that have been done? Like, and the people that did them. And, you know, well, I guess they had to enjoy it. Like, and it's a fascinating thing to contemplate as a semi-outside observer that he was. And clearly he just doesn't understand. Like, this is the only way that he can get to understand it.
Yeah. And I think that what it sounds like so far, they've been a slow drip of the storytelling of the Cardassian-Bajoran conflict, but it sounds like Goldicott is, even among the Cardassians who were harsh and were conquerors and were oppressors, he was particularly harsh for them. Like, I think I'm a little shocked that he received such a big stately funeral. And I wonder if Goldicott was overstating that a little bit, because it's like he's portrayed as particularly sort of nuts and harsh, even for this culture. So that one piece continues to surprise me and all of it. But it asks interesting questions. It asks, you know, how do we now going forward, like much like Kira, how do we continue to see the Cardassians? If next episode, episode 20, Cardassian arrives on a ship. We don't know him from Adam. His name's Bob Cardassian. And the guy walks on the ship. How do we view this guy now? Well, before we had a general idea of what we could expect, but it's become muddled for us just like Kira now, which I think is great for the storytelling going forward. Cause I don't think we're done with the Cardassians.
We are not. It does remind me, and maybe we can convince him to come on, that there are some, Cardassian trials that we get to interact with, and it'd be interesting to get Spencer's take on what he thinks of their legal system.
Well, you're not going to get a straight answer. He's going to say, well, you know, it's kind of good and kind of bad, and it's all, you know, it's all interesting.
I'd love to see him say it's kind of good. That'd be an interesting thing to get around. So Yeah, I mean, it is also interesting because there are so many layers that this gives to the Cardassians and puts in place for things to explore about the Cardassians and about the relationship with Bajor and everything else. Because, you know, maybe it was overstated by Gul Dukat how, you know, well received Guldur Hir was, but the other side of it is like, if, like, this was an occupation and a labor camp, and if the labor was producing what they wanted, like, how much did, you know, the people back on the home front know about what was going on in these camps? I mean, we know very well that very little of Germany knew what was going on in the death camps and labor camps. And so that aspect of the society is just divorced from, you know, the greater civilization there, maybe, or maybe it wasn't. Like, we just don't know.
I found it interesting that he continued to say, when he was finally broken down, he was talking honestly, right?
Yeah.
That it was necessary for the Cardassian people.
Yeah.
To, I don't think he used the word apologize, but to show accountability for what occurred. And he wasn't saying the Cardassian military or the ruling class or whatever. He was saying all Cardassians needed to show accountability for this atrocity.
Yep.
I liked that piece of it because that's how this guy views it. And I liked that perspective, which was, yeah, there were some commanders who were in control, who were making the decisions here. Some of them might have been mentally ill, whatever. But we had a people that passively allowed it to happen.
And yeah.
That's something we need to talk about.
I mean, I think that's something that, you know, one of the reasons that I think that this, excuse me, the episode hits so much is it's so applicable to so many parts of the human condition that, you know, we can point fingers at loads of other places. And then, you know, as they said in West Wing, you know, America's original sin of slavery. And that is something that, you know, we still seem to be trying to reckon with and is one of those things that is still a pervasive issue in society. And so the fact that...
Well, racism, not necessarily slavery. We did at least in that practice.
Yes. But the ramifications therein.
Sure.
Sure. You know, I guess was more what I was trying to get at. Like, maybe, you know, haven't been fully reckoned with, and you know, I don't know what it will take to fully reckon with them. And I think that's the thing that really comes out of this episode, which is when things like this happen in a society, they are reckoned with for a long period of time, and it, you know, it's often generations of change in a society when on either side of something like this happening.
Right.
And I don't know. It's yeah, that this is why people like Star Trek, Terry.
Yeah, I can see it. Yeah. I mean, you know, you have these little brief moments. Like, I was talking to my mom today.
Yeah.
And she's high school graduate, doesn't follow a lot of news, and not a big reader. And I was telling her about my, trying to explain to her why I support primate rescue centers and primate, support and relief efforts. And I was trying to explain to her the actual intelligence of a primate. And I was kind of talking through some of the talking points that we have as people who advocate for primates about, you know, the shared DNA percentage, which doesn't often help people, but the intellectual capacity of, you know, of a 6-year-old, that often will rattle people, or that they use their own language or tools, or they elect leaders, and that they have governing councils and a governance structure and their troops. And I was going through all this stuff, and she was like, she was like, her mind was blown that if they're that smart, that we don't, that we just like, we'll just destroy like, you know, thousands of them. And it's like not a crime. And it's like, fine. It's like, okay, no problem in certain countries, you know? And I was like, kind of, it all got broken down to like, well, I don't know, Mom. Like, I just think that when, I think most people are just thinking about like themselves. Like most people are just kind of thinking about like, what does my day look like? And am I going to have a good day or not? And it's like, that's kind of represented in a lot of what we're learning about the Cardassian conflict, is that having Bajor was likely economically helpful for the Cardassians. And so most of the Cardassian people just sort of passively allowed it to happen. They were thinking about what's best for me, what's best for mine. And they were kind of okay with it. And I think that's relatable in the story.
Yeah.
Disturbing, because we see some of ourselves in that. And it will make for a very interesting forward movement on this plot, right? Because you have so many chances to tell individual stories about, okay, you were a Cardassian, you did X in the war. How do we now feel about that? Like, considering that role, and you can drop that in another 10 times, and I'll be interested in it.
Yeah.
Didn't think I could work in primates there, did you?
Ha. I was curious where you're going with it, but you know, I think it's a reasonable thing to bring up.
Human selfishness landed the plane.
So, you know, I think we could talk about the bits of this episode and things that you know, interesting parallels to you know, modern day, you know, things that have happened in, you know, the past 50-100 years. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a really good episode that really ties you into what the conflict is, really what the Federation are doing there, the benefits of their presence, Odo being there helps, but like, let's say the Federation isn't there. What happens? You know, what happens with this guy?
Well, I don't think so. I think obviously the guy would get turned over. They'd have a war tribunal and they probably would have executed him fairly quickly. More interesting than that is Kira doesn't have the opportunity for growth that she has. And it's also important that this episode is where it is in the season, mm-hmm. because she, through numerous bits of trial and error, has come to trust Sisko. But she did not trust him in the first 5-8 episodes of the show.
And yeah, not at all.
This required her to trust him to a certain extent. Because there were moments where he bucked her, where he said, actually, I don't think we're going to turn him over if whatever, you know, you, because Kira would come in and say, well, if X happens and Y happens, then we're turning him over. And Sisko's like, no, I don't think so. And she didn't just immediately buck him or immediately go around him, because we also saw that happen in the season where she went around him. Went up the ladder, you know, went over to the provisional government to try to move Sisko. She didn't do any of that here because of that trust that we've built up in the first 18 episodes. So it was important that this episode be where it is chronologically in the season for the plot to work.
Yeah, 100%. I think we also got a good performance out of Avery Brooks as Sisko. It was a lot more muted than, you know, the wild dramatis persona episode. But
most of it's muted, I will say. He's a big fan of the muted, but I would agree. This was a moment for it.
Yeah.
This wasn't a moment where if he gave me more, I would have been happy. Like this was the appropriate amount. Because put yourself in that situation, right? He likes Kira. He respects Kira. He also knows that this situation has huge diplomatic ramifications.
Yeah.
And so he has got to be pensive and contemplative and reserved in this situation. This was the right moment for how Avery Brooks has acted season one. That's a great point.
So the other, I think this is a really good, other side of the coin to, I think it's progress.
Mm-hmm.
Where Kira is basically tasked with removing the last holdouts on a moon so they can, you know, progress with energy. And she sort of gets called that she's basically doing something not terribly different from the Cardassians. And so I feel like this is we see a little bit of what the extent of the horrors that the Cardassians inflicted on the Bajorans, but also, you know, what moving forward looks like. Coming to terms with, what moving forward as a culture looks like. There's sort of an interesting parallel that this reminds me of, that it took a long time, and, you know, it's still not done, I would say, but it took a very long time for, you know, anybody that I know to have any acceptance of, like, anything German. And, you know, VW has a sordid history, but, you know, I've had the direct conversation with my mother of, like, it's not the same people anymore. Like, you know, this is not the VW of World War II. And, you know, it, at some point, like, there's an acceptance of that, but, you know, it's not always easy. And so the Kira coming to understand some of the things that the Cardassians have inflicted on the Bajorans, maybe some ways past that and forward and dealing with that trauma. I think that we've gotten some really good episodes, and this is really the cherry, I think, in that series that we've had so far.
I agree. Best episode I've seen so far. Okay. Any thoughts about Odo, his sassiness, not really a sassy Odo episode, or the Federation as we wrap up?
So there is an Odo sassy that I do want to bring up. Okay. And another joke that I really, really like, because it's subtle enough that it doesn't take away from the episode, which is Maritza gets a Cardassian meal at the beginning. And he's like, you know, they do a good job, but, like, it's missing some yamak sauce.
Right.
Yep. And that yamak sauce was the stuff that Nog and Jake have traded for the self-sealing stem bolts. And sort of the joke that Quark made was, you know, there aren't Cardassians on the station anymore, so, you know, this stuff is completely useless and we can get rid of it.
Right. Yeah. So, it's a good callback there. I did note that one. Yamak sauce, very popular for the Cardassians. Jake could have hooked him up.
Yeah. And then Odo being sassy, he had a great line with Gul Dukat, and it's one that is not only great, but is one worth remembering, which is Gul Dukat, you know, is sort of reminiscing about the old days of them being, you know, when he was in charge of the station and Odo was the constable, and they played some game together. And Odo's like, yeah, they used to play this game together. And Odo's like, yeah, we played once and you cheated. And Gul Dukat was like, yeah, it was great. And Odo was just like, you're an idiot.
You did get that, like, sort of, because Gul Dukat's like, it's still the same Odo, like, backslapper, and Odo's like, this fucking guy.
Yeah. So I did appreciate that. I think that, you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, the role of the Federation, and I think that this is sort of like one of the episodes where the umbrella of the Federation, like, you see how important that is, because it allows for whatever healing that Kira's been able to do. And I think, hopefully, that's progressing to the larger group of, you know, Bajoran government and people, is more allowed to happen because they have structure for it. And the people that are in the provisional government have the resources to set up better tribunals and better functions of functional management. And, you know, they're, I, for one, like complaining about bureaucracy and red tape maybe more than the next person. But I think that in many instances, and this is one of the big ones, is like there's an importance for doing things correctly. And we get that both from Odo, but in the larger umbrella of the Federation, of there are appropriate ways to deal with a war criminal, and putting you up in front of a handful of people and be like, yep, you were there, you're guilty, and hang him, is a problem for everybody.
Not the right way to do it, no. Yep. And it doesn't establish good precedent. It doesn't establish, it's not the correct ethical and moral counterbalance to what occurred.
Yeah.
Like it's not what you're going for, in contrast to what occurred, you know, to try to set the path going forward. I think the role of the Federation and Sisko particularly was very important in this episode, obviously. And I like that you called out his muted performance. I like that he was very reserved, but also he had these kind of hard lines about turning the guy over, and he was not going to do it until it made sense to do it, right?
Yeah.
And until they actually learned something about the guy. I wasn't going to do it in haste, basically, is what I'm driving at. And I think that placing the episode where they did, Kira had much more respect for that process than she maybe has had in the previous 18 episodes. Like, it was sort of stunning to me, the moments where she was able to actually hold back. I mean, she was doing a lot of like gripping her fists and being like, "Arr, like I'm so frustrated," but she never bucked the system. She allowed it to play out. And so I've talked a lot about Kira's growth this episode, but that's another demonstration of it, is that she did allow Sisko to do his job.
Yep. This is, I forget how Kira centered a lot of this show is, and especially the first season. I mean, I think, you know, part of that is, you know, there are some stinkers in the first season, but like, she was not my favorite character.
No, you didn't set her up that way for sure. I mean, when we started watching, you were kind of like, yeah, you're going to get frustrated with this character. And I was, but she's become one of my favorite characters. I'm more excited when she's on screen than maybe anybody else sans Quark Oda.
Yeah. It is very interesting to see her growth on rewatch, in a way that, you know, I didn't look at it as much before.
All right. Fantastic. Enjoy doing the podcast, BJ. Yeah. This is great. This is a really good episode, and we will be back next week to review the finale of season one, episode 20. Should be a good one.
Yeah. I'm excited to talk to you about it. I'll have questions for you.
What's the name of it? Let's get the episode title name
for everybody. So it is In the Hands of the Prophets.
All right. Fantastic. I think I might know where we're going. In the Hands of the Prophets, that's what we're going to do next week. We'll see you then.